From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It appears as if there'll be new parliamentary elections in Serbia. We'll go to Belgrade with Jeremy Scahill. Israel has put off a deadline. We'll look at the significance and the projects. Low-income housing or toxic traps for poor people. Close to half of all U.S. federally subsidized houses are within 1 mile of toxic waste sites. And why exactly don't Americans vote? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The new government in Yugoslavia is reaching out to the West. France's foreign minister is in Belgrade today to invite the new Yugoslav president to a European Union summit meeting. This comes just a day after the Union lifted economic sanctions and offered Yugoslavia $2 billion in aid to help rebuild the country. Meanwhile, a key Kostunica ally signaled interest in restoring ties with the United States. The opposition had shunned the U.S. during last month's election campaign because of public hostility over the NATO bombing campaign, but now opposition leaders say ties with America are crucial. We turn now to Belgrade with Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy, let's start off with the latest news of what appears to be elections scheduled for December 17th for the Serbian parliament.
Well, there are very conflicting reports and portrayals of what exactly happened in Belgrade yesterday. What is clear is that two key allies of Slobodan Milosevic have definitely resigned. The first is Vlajko Stojiljković, who was the Minister of the Interior. He was the head of the notorious police force that was built up by Slobodan Milosevic over the course of the last decade. He apparently now is out. The Prime Minister of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, Momir Bilatovic, who is from Montenegro, he also resigned. Democratic Opposition of Serbia, as they are still known, apparently obtained an agreement from the President of Serbia, the Republic of Serbia, Milan Milutinovic, to step down and dissolve the Serbian parliament. Spokespeople from DOS said yesterday that they are now forming a transitional government of experts on the Republican level. This is important for them because they did not win elections on the Serbian level. They won them on the federal level, and many institutions on the Republican level are still controlled by allies of Slobodan Milosevic. This is a move by the new government of Kostunica to try to consolidate a power base that technically they don't have a right to consolidate. At yesterday's session of the Serbian parliament, there was a very heated debate. Vojislav Šešelj, who is the head of the right-wing ultra-nationalist Serbian Radical Party and a part-time ally of Slobodan Milosevic, said that his party had broken ranks with Milosevic in recognizing the victory of Vojislav Kostunica. But interestingly, Šešelj said that everything that has happened since they did that by the Democratic Opposition of Serbia has been reminiscent of like a coup. And Vojislav Šešelj said he was not going to participate in a coup. What he's referring to is that the government of Vojislav Kostunica has been strong-arming Serbian institutions, such as the police force and the customs agency, taking them over at times by force. Zoran Djindjic, who many feel is the power behind Vojislav Kostunica, he's the head of the Democratic Party, someone who traveled abroad during the bombing, met with Madeleine Albright, apparently went into the Federal Customs Agency and by force essentially procured the resignation of the top customs official in the country. There are reports that this also happened at police precincts within Yugoslavia, so it appears as though the new federal government of Vojislav Kostunica is really trying to crack down on the government of the Republic of Serbia, which legally they don't actually have a right to do. So it appears as though the Republican government has either been threatened or strong-armed into stepping down and calling for new elections December 17th. The Democratic Opposition of Serbia is viewed widely to be able to win those elections and to have a member of the opposition become the new president of the Serbian Republic. So really what we're seeing is a consolidation of power, sometimes overreaching the law.
And what about Kosovo? Yesterday you talked about Kostunica's view that Kosovo should remain a part of Yugoslavia.
Well, ethnic Albanian leaders in Kosovo are furious right now that Vojislav Koshinica is the president of Yugoslavia. They say that he's exactly like Milosevic to them. What's interesting is that Slobodan Milosevic provided an alibi not only to Kosovo Albanians, but to the United States to maintain a policy of what has essentially been terror in Kosovo. More than 150,000 Serbs have been expelled from Kosovo in the year since NATO troops began their occupation. The place is an utter hell for ethnic minorities, and Kosovo Albanians have been able to use the government of Slobodan Milosevic to justify the massive aid that they're giving, that they're getting from the West, and also to justify the military attacks that they're doing into eastern Serbia, parts of Yugoslavia that are not even recognized as Kosovo. Yesterday and today, both, there were attacks into Serbia, invasions by former members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. Vojislav Koshinica is facing somewhat of a political crisis right now because he's going to have to respond, probably militarily, to attacks on the sovereignty of Yugoslavia.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Democracy Now! Correspondent. Now, what did you say? You think that he will be responding militarily? You think that's a possibility with the amount of money that he's being offered by Europe and probably very soon the United States?
What I'm saying is that I think that Vojislav Koshinica is going to face a massive credibility problem here in Yugoslavia if he does not address the fact that the border of Kosovo, which is still a province of Serbia, is being expanded by the fact that members of the Kosovo Liberation Army, former members, are invading Serbia proper, parts of Serbia that are not even recognized as being Kosovo. They are directly challenging the presidency of Vojislav Koshinica because they say he's a nationalist and that they're going to continue with their actions. If Vojislav Koshinica does not raise the issue of Kosovo, he's going to have significant portions of the Serbian public turn on him and demand that he do something.
But given the level of support that the KLA has gotten from the West, don't you think they'll back off now that someone else that they support, Koshinica, is in power?
Absolutely not. I think that the Kosovo Liberation Army are not people that are going to be easily reined in by the United States, despite the fact that the U.S. has been aiding them in carrying out their agenda. They very much are nervous about the fact that the West is now getting very friendly with Vojislav Koshinica because they see it as their feeding trough being reduced, because a lot of aid is going to start coming into Serbia. And quite frankly, it's easier for Vojislav Koshinica to negotiate a more favorable position with Kosovo from the perspective of Serbs than it would have been for Milosevic because of the Hague indictment and because of the vilification by the Western media and Western governments. Vojislav Koshinica is actually going to be in a much stronger position to call into question the way in which the United States and other Western European countries have really created this state of terror within Kosovo. I should point out that an interesting thing that's been developing here in Yugoslavia is that the media, which is often referred to under the regime of Slobodan Milosevic as state-run and a propaganda media, has almost taken a 180-degree shift and has become a propaganda organ for the government of Vojislav Koshinica. There is almost no critical reporting whatsoever of his government. The issues of the IMF and the World Bank coming in here are not being raised. The head of the Stability Pact for Europe is coming to Yugoslavia tomorrow. There are no critical articles about neoliberalism, about the IMF World Bank funding. It's all very positive press coverage for Vojislav Koshinica and the new government, and I think that what we're seeing right now is Vojislav Koshinica consolidating not only federal and Serbian institutions, but also the media as well.
Jeremy Scahill, I want to thank you for being with us as we get our regular reports from you from Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to another headline story today, and that is what is happening in the Middle East. Israel has caved to international pressure, says it will give international mediators more time to end the violence between Israel and Palestinians. A statement issued by Prime Minister Ehud Barak's office after the expiration of the 48 hours he'd given Palestinians to stop clashes indicated he's willing to extend that deadline. According to Israel Army Radio, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak said he made the decision after speaking with President Clinton. We're joined on the telephone right now by Professor Nasir Arouri, who teaches political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. What do you make of this extension, Professor Arouri?
Well, I think that the extension really is a relief to the Palestinians, especially the civilians who have taken the brunt of it with nearly 100 people dead and more than 2,000 injured, as much as it is, I think, to Barak and his government, because I think that Barak has really put himself in a quandary when he gave that deadline 2 days ago. The question is, what was he going to do? I mean, this is not really a war between two armed nations. You have basically people living under occupation, under Israeli occupation, and they've been waging a struggle for independence. So what was he going to do? I mean, the question is, would he send his tanks and helicopters now against all these civilians? You know, he did use these tanks and helicopters against demonstrators, but, I mean, did the deadline mean that it was going to be an all-out massacre? This is really the question that's been on many people's minds. So I think that the extension is probably a welcome relief to both sides. I do want to emphasize, however, here that the extension is going to give a chance to the mediators to see if they can arrange for a settlement. The issue is settlement on what basis? I mean, if it's going to be on the basis of Oslo, as Oslo is being interpreted by the United States and by Israel, because they took a similar stand on it, then I think it's a non-starter. I mean, this is an issue that really belongs to the world community, to the United Nations. Most conflicts were resolved by the UN and are being resolved by the UN. This has been taken away from the United Nations, and for the past 9 years, it has really produced nothing. And that is the explanation for the demonstrations. These are demonstrations against Arafat's regime as much as they are against Israel. And so to expect Arafat to call the demonstrations off, I mean, is not really, it's foolhardy, because he does not have a remote control. And as I said, these are really against his regime, which has been working in tandem with Israel for the past 9 years.
You've been reading the U.S. press. Robert Fisk had an interesting column in the British press in The Independent, the Middle East correspondent for that newspaper. He said when the U.S. press talks about crossfire, that means that Palestinians were killed by Israelis. That's as far as they're willing to go. We have a figure now, a death toll at something like 88. Who knows if someone has been killed since this program came on, overwhelmingly Palestinian. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that what Robert Fisk has written in that article is quite correct. It's too bad that this is not really what is being told. I mean, that's not what the media have been telling the American people for the past 10, 11 days. I mean, if one even reads some of the writings by Israelis, by some of the Israelis in the peace camp, like Uri Avneri, let us take that for an example. I mean, Uri Avneri said the other day that Israeli forces have been training for this kind of thing for quite some time, and they've been training specifically for the use of helicopters, for the use of snipers, the sharpshooters who actually have been given orders to shoot to kill. That's why most of the health personnel testified that the casualties that came to the hospitals, most of them were hit from the chest and above. So it's not a question of a crossfire here. I mean, everyone saw on television the picture of Mohammed Abdurra and his father trying to protect him. This is not a crossfire whatsoever. Demonstrations are not quelled by the use of air-to-ground missiles and by tanks. You see, I think what is happening in the occupied territories and in the Arab world, which seems to be united behind the Palestinians today, is utter frustration. That why did Mr. Clinton say the other day, why did he applaud the victory of the masses in Belgrade, in Yugoslavia, and yet when you have this rebellion for independence, this is being called violence, and then Arafat has to stop the violence. So there is really an utter frustration in the region as a whole. And I'm afraid that we have probably reached a turning point now. What really worries me most about this is that here is a conflict between people struggling for independence and an occupier that is threatening to become now perhaps a religious conflict, to take on this rather ominous dimension. And that, I think, could throw the whole region into turmoil.
Nasir Arouri, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Thank you. And we're going to move to another international issue intimately connected to the United States. Jury selection begins today in Florida for the trial of two former top Salvadoran officers who are accused of directing the rape and murder of four American church women, murders which took place December 2, 1980 in El Salvador. The suit's been brought by the families of the four women under the Torture Victim Protection Act, which is a federal statute designed to give the victims of the worst crimes or their surviving kin the chance to confront both the crime's direct perpetrators as well as the officials who had the authority and responsibility to ensure that the acts did not take place. We're joined now by Miriam Ford, who is the niece of one of those four church women, Ida Ford. Miriam Ford is a nurse practitioner who founded the Ida Ford Health Clinic in East Harlem, which serves undocumented immigrants. Miriam Ford, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us who the two men are on trial?
These men who are going on trial today are Carlos Eugenio Vitas Casanova and Jose Guillermo Garcia. Vitas Casanova was the director of the National Guard, and Guillermo Garcia was the Minister of Defense at the time that my aunt and Dorothy Cazel, Maura Clark, and Gene Donovan were murdered.
How did these men end up in Florida?
Well, that's actually a very good question. We don't know how they ended up in Florida, and it was not until my dad and some of the other family members were doing an interview with Brian Gumbel, and he told them that he had found out that they were in Florida, that we knew they were there, and that was sometime last year. And so once we found out that they were there, we were able to go after them.
Can you briefly tell us what happened to your aunt and the three other nuns in El Salvador, December 2nd, 1980?
Ida Ford and Maura Clark were Marianal sisters, and they were living and working in a part of El Salvador called Chalatenango. They were working with refugees, internally displaced people. If you remember, in 1980, there was a civil war going on that was backed by the U.S. government. And Dorothy Cazel was a Ursuline sister, and Jean Donovan was a laywoman, and they were working in a part of El Salvador called La Libertad. In December 2nd of 1980, Ida and Maura were coming back from Nicaragua from a Marianal retreat. Dorothy and Jean picked them up at the airport to take them home. They never made it home. They were stopped along the highway by some soldiers. They were taken to the side of the road. They were assaulted and murdered and left there.
Who were the men who actually did the killing?
There were five National Guardsmen who were wearing civilian clothes, and they were led by a sub-sergeant whose name is Luis Calindres Alemán, and they were the ones who actually killed them.
What happened to them?
Well, they actually were on trial, and they were found guilty, and they were put in jail. And in 1998, three of the guardsmen were released from prison. And there are, I believe, two guardsmen still in prison, but they will probably be released also under an amnesty law in El Salvador.
And how are you able to prove the direct culpability of these senior Salvadoran military men now being sued by your family in a West Palm Beach court?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is push for the truth. This is just one further step in getting to the truth. The Truth Commission in El Salvador found out that the guardsmen and the sergeant obeyed orders from higher, obeyed higher orders. And they Truth Commission also said that the defense minister at the time, Guillermo Garcia, made no serious effort to thoroughly investigate those guilty of the assassinations. So the thinking is that these are men who allowed a system of torture and violence to go on under them, and so they created a climate where rape and murder was just common.
And what about the culpability of the United States? This happened under the Carter administration, and the investigations, I guess, went through the Reagan-Bush years.
Well, the family, 20 years later, we have been filing Freedom of Information Act materials for years and years and years, and the materials continue to come back redacted. We get small amounts of information every couple of years, but clearly the Carter administration was on its last legs. If you remember, there was a hostage crisis going on at the time in the Middle East, and the Carter administration was consumed with this hostage crisis. When Reagan and Bush came in, there was a brief stop of military aid, and the military aid just was started up again, and it was started up with a vengeance. Pay for the uniforms, to pay for the trucks, to pay for the guns that killed not only my aunt and her three co-workers, but at least 75,000 other Salvadoran people.
We're coming up on the 20th anniversary of Ida Ford and her co-workers' deaths. What are you calling for in this trial?
We're calling for the truth. We want to know what happened on December 2nd. We want to know who gave the orders. And we want to know why people, good people, who are fleeing torture from all over the world are having such a terrible time getting into this country. Once they sneak into the country, they're treated terribly. And here, people who have been implicated in torture and murder of thousands upon thousands of their own citizens are allowed to live freely and very well as North Americans. Were able to access the judicial system in a way that peasants from El Salvador are unable to. And so this is not just about my aunt and Dorothy and Jean and Maura. This is about all of the people who were killed during the war and finding out, getting to the truth of what happened to them.
Miriam, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Miriam Ford, the niece of Ida Ford, one of the four churchwomen killed December 2nd, 1980, murdered on a road in El Salvador by a Salvadoran National Guardsman. Today, the trial begins of the head of the National Guard, the former head, as well as the former Minister of Defense of El Salvador in a West Palm Beach court. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you want more information on that case, by the way, you can go to the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights website. That's lchr.org. We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. A three-part series just came out in the Dallas Morning News called Toxic Traps. And it says that close to half of U.S. federally subsidized houses are within a mile of a toxic waste site. We're joined right now by some of the residents of public housing, as well as a deputy chief of staff for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which oversees public housing, and Craig Flournoy, who's an investigative journalist with the Dallas Morning News for 22 years. He's covered HUD. He was Pulitzer Prize winner for a series on racial discrimination in public housing, and now has taken on this issue, which is entitled Toxic Traps. Craig Flournoy, can you tell us what you found?
Yes, ma'am. We found three primary things. Number one, we found that there are some 800,000 families who live within a mile of one or more toxic factories. Number two, we found that these families are disproportionately minority. That is to say that of all minority families in subsidized housing, both Section 8 housing and public housing, more than one out of every two live within a mile of one or more of these factories, compared to about one of three white families. And finally, we found that the government is in the midst of spending $4 billion to ensure that this problem continues. The government has a program called HOPE 6. It is the biggest public housing rebuilding program that is going on currently, and unfortunately, they are rebuilding public housing in many of these same polluted neighborhoods.
How did you get onto the story?
I got onto the story 7 years ago. It just took a long time to put together, but 7 years ago, the government had a plan to double the number of families in the West Dallas Public Housing Project in Dallas. They were going to add 1,000 families to what was already one of the largest projects in the country. Unfortunately, it was right across the street from a lead smelter that had spewed lead particles for more than 50 years. The government said that wasn't a problem. We investigated it. We found that it was. And Henry Cisneros, to his credit, killed the plan. It caused me to ask the question, how many other West Dallas projects are there out there like that? And eventually, it took us a long time to actually obtain the data. We found out that there are a heck of a lot of other West Dallas projects out there. If I could just give one example to try to put this in some kind of perspective, because numbers can sort of blind us at some point. Take the town of Chester, Pennsylvania. It's a little suburb outside of Philadelphia. The EPA has conducted what are called cumulative studies there, where they measure all the emissions from the factories in and around Chester to see what kind of toxic impact it has. And what they have found in studies in 1994 and 1995 is that the cumulative impact of those air emissions has caused an increased likelihood of cancer for Chester residents. Despite this, the government has committed $40 million to rebuild three public housing projects in Chester. When I interviewed all three of the resident council leaders in Chester, every single one said the same thing, which is they shouldn't rebuild a stick of this housing until they address the pollution problem. One of them, a woman named Ella Thompson, was particularly eloquent. This is what she had to say. She said, quote, this, meaning the program, is genocide on poor black people.
Well, Doug Cantor, these are very serious charges. You're deputy chief of staff for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is running these programs. What's your response?
My response is that, unfortunately, I think Craig Flournoy and the Dallas Morning News found what is a real issue that we all have to face and deal with, and chose, rather than to face it head on and face the difficult questions that reside there, to over-dramatize and sensationalize the situation, using a measurement of 1 mile from sites on a couple of different EPA lists doesn't tell us where there are serious issues of environmental concerns in housing authorities. We know that there are some areas where there are issues, and those have to be dealt with. But by taking too broad a cut at what housing authorities are out there and over-dramatizing the issue, they put a very different factor into play, which is, as Craig Flournoy is pointing out, you cannot deal with that number of housing authorities. And in fact, most of us, a great many of us, live within a mile of many of these sites and would have no problem with it. There are places like dry cleaners and things that we think of as not a big deal on some of these EPA lists. But that should not be the measure. And in fact, you know,
There have been historically some problems with siting of public housing. We know that. We've talked about that in the department quite a bit. And the issue is, how do you deal with those historic patterns of segregation and other problems with the historic siting of public housing? And we think we are doing that. Hope 6 is one way we're doing that. Craig mentioned our Hope 6 program, which is the program by which we tear down and rebuild public housing. What it does is find the worst public housing out there, tear it down, and rebuild, but only rebuild some of it. In fact, it runs about, we rebuild about two-thirds or so of the units we tear down. The other third are vouchers that allow the tenants of those housing to choose where they live, like anyone else in the private rental market.
Craig Flournoy, did you cut too large a swath? I mean, 1 mile, a lot of people live within that, the HUD official says.
No, he's correct. I mean, a lot of people do live within 1 mile. The way we developed 1 mile, we did a lot of reading of the literature, then we met with one of the top EPA toxicologists in Dallas for the, what's called the EPA Region 6, and he suggested 1 mile. We looked a lot of the literature, and it all suggested 1 mile. We have a website that we set up, and you can go onto the website at www.dallasnews.com, and you can put in your address. You can find out what's within a mile. We felt 1 mile was the best distance that we could come up with to use. As far as over-dramatizing it, though, this isn't the first. We weren't the first to come up and suggest that there's a problem here. There have been at least 3 studies that have been done in which researchers have warned HUD that the location of subsidized housing creates a serious problem in terms of pollution. For example, there was a study done a few years ago by researchers at the University of South Carolina. They examined 8 mid-sized cities randomly selected across the country. In all but one of those cities, in other words, in 7 of the 8, they found that residents of subsidized housing had a significantly greater exposure to toxic pollution than residents of private housing. We are not the first ones to come up with this. We are only trying to take on something that, to date, neither HUD nor the EPA has been willing to take on. We're the first entity that I'm aware of to actually go out and try to do a nationwide examination of that. Can we do a better job? Absolutely we can. But we thought we've made a heck of a first start at it. And I'd like to throw in that when we ran out, we tried our best to interview HUD about this. We spent months trying to interview Andrew Cuomo as well as his top deputies. We provided them with an explanation of our methodology, our findings, and a list of written questions. They refused to a person to even meet with us. This echoes what happens with the studies. We talked to the authors of the South Carolina and other studies who said when they turned in their information, they never heard back from HUD. We did run our information past former HUD officials. They were willing to meet with us. They were willing to discuss it with us. And this is what Henry Cisneros, who was Mr. Cuomo's predecessor, had to say about our main findings. He said, quote, "It is an American tragedy. It means we are exposing children from their earliest years to asthma and respiratory problems and skin problems, but we sweep it under the rug and forget about it."
Doug Cantor?
Yeah, I would say, you know, unfortunately, again, Mr. Flournoy is going overboard with this. You know, this is about an issue for residents and public policy, not about the interview. But I would say, in terms of the Dallas Morning News, they gave us extensive written questions, and we gave them extensive written answers. It was unfortunate to me that I didn't see as much of our written answers in the stories as I would have liked that would have provided the full context of the fact.
Why not speak with them directly as opposed to provide written answers?
Well, we certainly talked with them on the phone in order to understand what they were doing and know what they were looking at.
But on background is different. On background is different.
It is absolutely different. And I'll tell you exactly why. It is just this type of thing that, unfortunately, every time we heard from Mr. Flournoy and his colleagues, they were taking our data and our information out of context, as they did in the story, and trying to take an issue that, as I said, was a real issue that we should discuss, and instead sensationalize it for their own purposes. And that is not a situation where it was useful to have anyone do a direct interview. We gave them our written answers. We gave them quite a bit of information, including a letter from the head researcher at the University of South Carolina that Mr. Flournoy mentions, who had some very significant caveats in her work. And in fact, we've talked to Dr. Susan Cutter about doing more work, which is what she recommended. She did not recommend making public policy changes based on her work at that time.
Let me bring Pastor Roy Malvo into the conversation, who's head of People Against a Contaminated Environment in Texas City, Texas. What are your major concerns, and what is the housing project that you are most familiar with, Pastor Malvo? If you could come as close to the phone, we could hardly hear you.
Okay. Let me say, first of all, that I'm deeply concerned that one of our officials would say and try to desensitize this issue and say that the Dallas Morning News is over-dramatizing, overstating, or over-sensationalizing and giving too broad. As a matter of fact, with all due respect to the article, I really believe that you can't over-dramatize death.
What are you finding?
Well, I live in these neighborhoods, and I'm seeing children's lives being placed in danger because somebody wants to live deliciously. This is what I see. These industrial communities are getting large amounts of federal funding. They're getting, especially the state government. In Texas here, we have a program called the Enterprise Zone, where there's monies put into these neighborhoods that actually gives them the right to continue to pollute. And they lock people into these dangerous environments in these industrial communities, and the state and local governments actually make money by keeping those industrial communities locked in because they get those federal grants and those enterprise and state and local funds, and therefore the pollution is actually tied to politicians or to monies that they get from the government. And I really think that to try to desensitize the fact that these people are being, we are, not these people, but we are actually being genocide. This is giving them the okay to build new. We already know that there's a problem. We already know that there are schools in these areas that are in direct path to pollution sites. We already know that there's MTBE being emitted through fugitive emissions. We know all of that. And what the communities like People Against Contaminated Environments have done, we have networked with other grassroots environmental groups like Sierra Club and Communities for a Better Environment and the National Oil Refinery Network. And we've created what's called Bucket Brigade, where we have the information to know that our government entities know what's going on in our neighborhood.
I want to bring Sally Dickens into the conversation, who's a mother of two and a resident of the Grand Camp Projects in Texas City, Texas, where you are also, Pastor Malvo. Can you describe the Grand Camp Projects?
Yes, the Grand Camp Projects, they are a project that has been sitting here for a long time before I even got here. Matter of fact, we are living very close to the plants. I mean, we are one street over from the plants. And
what plant?
It's like Amoco, Carbide, Sterling, different plants around in the area, surround in this area. And within not even a mile from it, we're right across the street from it, matter of fact.
And how are your kids and other people, other residents, affected?
Well, my kids have a lot of respiratory respiratory infections, skin rashes, just you name it. Sometimes they're even going to so far as vomiting because of the smells and things that they have here. The doctors told me that I need to move, but when you're on a fixed income, how can you move? And you have to reach a limit to where, you know, to what you can do, really.
Well, let me ask Doug Kanner, Deputy Chief of Staff for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Would you say these are just anecdotal stories?
No, not at all. You know, there are places, as I said at the outset, where there are problems. There are clearly problems. Texas City is one of those examples. That's why, and to say to Pastor although I don't want my comments to be misinterpreted, I was not saying that some of those individual places and residents like Sally Dickens and their stories were over-dramatized. That's not the import of my comments at all. Obviously, where people are suffering health effects, that is a huge, huge problem. But what the Dallas Morning News did was detract from the individual places where there are problems by grafting on this over-dramatized study of the one-mile test. And as I say, that is a universe of places that is too big to really deal with. What we ought to look at are these individual places and sit down with Pastor Malveaux, the Sally Dickens Texas City Housing Authority, and see what can be done.
Have you done that?
Well, our issue, unfortunately, is that this is one, for example, where they have not, the Housing Authority comes to us to say they want to demolish and do a Hope 6, find a way to rebuild and come up with a plan. We are, unfortunately, dependent on well over 3,000 housing authorities around the nation, and in working with them, and we're dependent often on the information we get from them. And until the housing authorities come to us, it's very difficult.
You mean the state housing authority?
Typically they're not state entities. They're local entities. But, yeah, those local entities have a lot to say. I mean, in fact, as you know, the trend in government has been to give more and more influence to local government, local decision-making, and including, in this case, local housing authorities.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, a quick sum up, and I'll ask Sally Dickens and Pastor Roy Malveaux, who live in Texas City, Texas, what question you have or what demand you have of the federal housing and urban development department that Doug Cantor represents. He's saying that it's the local housing authorities that have not approached them federally, and that's when they would step in. Our guest also, Craig Flournoy, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, who's part of the team that did this three-part series in the Dallas Morning News, Toxic Traps. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute, and after this conversation, we'll speak with Francis Fox Piven on the issue of why people don't vote. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue in this discussion of, well, what the Dallas Morning News called toxic traps, look at the federally subsidized housing in this country. And the Dallas Morning News says close to half of that housing is located near toxic waste sites, whether factories or dumps. We're joined on the phone by a representative of the Housing and Urban Development Department, Doug Cantor. He's Deputy Chief of Staff. Craig Flournoy is one of the team that's been doing this research for the Dallas Morning News. And Sally Dickens and Pastor Roy Malveaux are residents of Texas City, Texas. Pastor Roy Malveaux, a demand for the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'm not in Texas City, even though I've traveled there to do some work in the environment. I resided a few years ago in Corpus Christi, Texas. Now I'm in Beaumont, Texas. But my answer is the same, because all of these communities have the same problem. And so these are across the Texas state lines. We have refineries in just about every minority neighborhood. There were 16 in Corpus Christi, about 11 here in Beaumont, about 8 or 9 in the Port Arthur area. So this is not an isolated incident. But my demand would be to our chief here that, you know, when we know we have a problem, to go back and build housing in an area that's already have a problem, it's nothing but murder by proxy. And
Doug Kanner, let me get a response from the Deputy Chief of Staff of HUD.
Yeah, well, the areas where we know we have the problem are not areas where we're rebuilding. When we rebuild, we do environmental assessments. We make sure that there is not a problem, or if there's a problem, it's either cured or we won't rebuild there. There's no two ways about that. I think the pastor actually didn't know the pastor was from Beaumont. It's an interesting example because just last week we did make an announcement in Beaumont where because of the civil rights stances taken by that housing authority, we went in and took over. So there, when we know there's a problem, we have acted in a very activist way to move in and try to remedy a problem.
Sally Dickens?
But you gave money to build houses right adjacent to Mobile, and you did the same thing in Port Arthur, and you did the same thing in Corpus Christi.
Sally Dickens?
Yes. Well, I think that what they can do is really to help us get out of these areas. I mean, get some kind of program going on where that we can as residents can move out of this area, or build the places somewhere else besides right beside these chemical plants.
Is there that kind of program, Doug Kanter, to move residents out of these areas so close to factories that emit pollutants?
What we've tried to do is through our Section 8 voucher program, as I said, give more and more residents vouchers rather than build hard units that are placed in a particular location. And then those vouchers can move with the residents. They can find where they want to rent. In
so
fact,
you would give Sally Dickens, for example, vouchers?
That is what's been the trend of our program, is more and more vouchers.
Let me ask Sally Dickens, have you gotten a voucher?
No, I don't have a voucher. They need to give vouchers. And then if you're not on Section 8 and on this waiting list that you have to wait for so long to get into these programs, and if you don't have a certain, your income does not come up to a certain criteria, then you cannot even get on these programs. So, you know, it's a thing where we need to, it needs to be something done, because there are people that are on fixed incomes that cannot get on these programs.
I'm going to give Craig Flournoy the last word from the Dallas Morning News. As you look at areas like the Grand Camp projects where Sally Dickens lives around the country.
What's your question?
The question, giving you the last word.
Well, my last word is this. Doug said that the local housing authorities really drive this train. He also said they don't rebuild in polluted neighborhoods. Well, the Whole Hope 6 program is something that was conceived of, created, funded, and is operated out of Washington, D.C. And just to give you one specific example, I'll just try to cite facts so I won't over-dramatize anything. In 1994, the EPA declared the Agricultural Street landfill there a toxic Superfund site, the most toxic Superfund site in the country, I mean, one of the most toxic waste sites in the country. That same year, HUD to rebuild the Desire Public Housing Project, which borders that same Superfund site. A few years later, HUD approved more money, even though a study came out that was a joint state and federal study that found that women in that particular area, including the Desire Public Housing Project, had a 70% higher incidence of breast cancer than others in a surrounding three-county area. The point is that HUD is continuing to do this, and that HUD knows this. The reason I say I know that HUD knows this is one of the people we interviewed for this is a woman named Elizabeth Julian, who was formerly the top civil rights lawyer at HUD. And she said that while she was at HUD during the first Clinton's first term, and when Desire was funded, she said officials approved Hope 6 money for projects such as Desire, even though they knew it would put residents in segregated, environmentally questionable neighborhoods. Let me finish with her direct quote. Quote, "We knew what the results would be. The local political reality was this. It may be a hellhole and a toxic dump, but it's our hellhole and toxic dump." End quote.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Sally Dickens and Pastor Roy Malveaux from the Grand Camp Projects in Texas City and Beaumont, Texas, Doug Cantor, the Deputy Chief of Staff for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and Craig Flournoy of the Dallas Morning News. The series is called Toxic Traps, and you can see it at www.dallasnews.com. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! It's hard to think of voting when you're besieged by the kind of issues we've been hearing about today, but perhaps others are spurred to vote. Well, not most Americans. In fact, in the last election, less than half of Americans voted. President Clinton, I think, won on 27% of the vote. Why Americans Still Don't Vote and Why Politicians Want It That Way is a book written by Frances Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. Frances Fox Piven joins us now. She's a professor of political science and sociology at the City University of New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Glad to talk to you, Amy.
So why? Why don't we vote?
Well, there are two kinds of reasons that people don't vote. One set of reasons has to do with the arrangements that make it difficult for them to vote. You know, for a long time in the United States, people had to pass literacy tests, pay poll taxes, not only in the South, by the way, but also in the North. And they had to get themselves registered to vote. And the officials appointed by the parties that ran those voter registration arrangements typically made it difficult to register to vote. You could only register at one place in the county. You could only register during working hours. The people that ran voter registration were unfriendly, hostile, intimidating, likely to embarrass a less confident prospective voter. And over time, as these arrangements were developed, they were instigated by the Republicans at the end of the 19th century in the North, but by the Democrats in the South. And they were instigated precisely because each party was afraid. In the North, the Republicans were afraid of the immigrant working classes that were pouring into the cities and were becoming naturalized and raising new kinds of issues having to do with working conditions, for example. And in the South, the old Democratic Party was never liked the fact that the national government had, in a sense, enfranchised black people once they were freed, but had been ineffective in preventing blacks from voting just by using violence and intimidation. And by the 1880s, 1890s, they began to develop legal or legalistic, quasi-legal methods for disenfranchising blacks. Particularly, this became particularly urgent because they were afraid that blacks would form an alliance with radicalized dirt farmers who were joining in the populist movement. The result of these arrangements was to effectively drive lower strata voters out of the electorate all over the country. We had very high turnout in the 19th century, 80% turnout in presidential elections. Compared to now, it's 49%. But once these arrangements went into effect, the turnout dropped, and it dropped particularly among the people who were, in a sense, targeted by what appeared to be neutral provisions. You had to pay a poll tax, or you had to pass a literacy test. But, of course, these were not neutral provisions. They were provisions which singled out people who were less educated, less well off, had to work 10 hours a day, didn't have the time to register to vote. So by the 1920s, turnout fell to 49%, just what it is today.
80 years later.
That's right. Now, in the interim between the 1920s and the year 2000, turnout bobbed up and down, and it did rise, although not very much, during the 1930s. It rose in response not to the political parties. You know, the political parties, you take political science 101, and you learn that the political parties are the key agents of democracy, that it's the political parties that name the issues that people care about and then mobilize voters around those issues, go door to door to try to pull them out. But in fact, the American political parties have never functioned that way. You could make a stronger case, and we do make the case, that the political parties have tried to win elections not by mobilizing voters, but by demobilizing significant segments of the age-eligible voting population. One way was through these legal and procedural obstacles, but once these had, in a sense, done their dirty work and made it less likely that certain strata would vote, low-income people would vote, working people would vote, minorities would vote, the political parties ignored these groups. It became easier to run elections, cheaper because you had fewer in the electorate, but most importantly, easier because the people who were likely to raise controversial issues, issues that would be very uncomfortable for the moneyed backers of the parties, were not in the electorate. And so this really brings us to our situation today, where we have actually, as a result, not of party politicians, but as a result of the civil rights movement and good government groups, we have overcome many of the procedural obstacles. The Voting Rights Act effectively outlawed literacy tests. The Constitution was amended
in 1965.
That's right. And we also had a constitutional amendment in the 1960s which outlawed poll taxes. Those were big steps. And then in the 1993, the legislation known as Motor Voter was passed, which made voter registration available in many more sites, particularly in driver's license agencies and in welfare, Medicaid, WIC agencies. Now, the implementation in welfare, Medicaid, WIC agencies has been very reluctant and uneven. But driver's license voter registration does work. So many more people are getting registered, but the political parties are not oriented toward those new voters, toward those young voters, those low-income voters. And so that we're now in a situation where it's not mainly the legal barriers, although it would help if Election Day was a holiday. It's not mainly the legal barriers, but it's the failure of the political parties to name the issues, to name the candidates that would resonate with the grievances and the aspirations of ordinary people.
We're going to bring our listeners part two of this interview tomorrow, but I want to end with this question. It's about the debates. Tomorrow night is another of the debates. We're calling them Debate Light number two, sponsored by Anheuser-Busch and Budweiser Light. Do you think they play a role in demobilizing voters?
Well, the debates could play a role in mobilizing voters, obviously, if they were vigorous, if the candidates looked different, sounded different, if you could understand their inscrutable policy proposals, and if they allowed candidates who reflected dissenting and minority positions into the debates. But the Commission on Presidential Debates, not only is it funded by big corporations, but it's run by the two major parties who don't want any dissenting voices, who have kept Nader out of the debates.
Actually, there's going to be another super rally here in New York on Friday night at Madison Square Garden for Ralph Nader. But we do have to wrap up this discussion. Part two with Frances Fox Piven tomorrow on Democracy Now!, her book with Richard Cloward, Why Americans Still Don't Vote and Why Politicians Want It That Way. Democracy Now! Produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sid Rock Franklin. Special thanks to Deepa Fernandez, Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.